Thank you very much, Anne. And Bruce, thank you very much for the invitation to speak before your lab Infotech. When I first started my career, someone very wise told me, never apologize to your audience. Well, I'm going to break that rule, and I'm going to apologize to you ahead of time just in case I break out into a fit of coughing or my voice croaks like it's doing right now. My allergies have just started raging down here. I don't know if it's being confined inside the smoke-filled casinos or what. I think I've had probably a total of 60 minutes of fresh air time the whole time I've been here. And I feel like I've got that little character on the Mucinex commercial rattling around in here. So I apologize. Tried to have enough drugs on board that I deal with these symptoms without becoming more stuporous than I usually am. Now, when Bruce asked me to present before you and gave me this topic, he said, please don't talk about specific products and services that reference laboratories provide as value adds to their clients, and in particular, don't talk about products from our laboratory. So with that in mind, I'm going to try and keep this at a pretty high level and talk about some more general concepts about where the challenges are today, and I think we all know where those challenges are, and where are the opportunities to work together as partners between a hospital laboratory and their reference laboratory to mitigate and, in some cases, solve those problems. So it's going to be a broad brush approach. I was going through the list of attendees, and I couldn't quite tell if there are any hospital administrators in the audience. Are any of you hospital administrators or members of the hospital C-suite? Okay, I see one hand back there. Clary, when we talk about pain points for hospitals, I'm not speaking, obviously, with the perspective of a hospital administrator, but at the University of Utah, ARUP Laboratories is part of a large clinical enterprise that includes several hospitals within that system. And we talked to our CEO of the hospital, and clearly I think we understand what he feels are the pain points for his hospital, and I'm going to sort of generalize that a bit. I put this up mostly to say that in a typical day, I wear actually two general hats. One is, as a practicing pathologist, I'm a user of the reference laboratory. So when things don't go well, and I have my little pain points, you know, my productivity, my daily work activity suffers from it. So in that sense, I'm a user. I also wear the hat on the administrative side, so that makes me a vendor. So sometimes I'm a little schizophrenic about who I am. I thought I would set the stage, and several of the previous speakers, both today and yesterday, have also done so, to talk about what are really the short-term realities, especially in today's economy, and then what are the longer-term possibilities, not only for hospitals and the practice of laboratory medicine, but relationships with reference laboratories. Talk a little bit about what hospitals do, and I'll reference back to our keynote speaker yesterday, Dr. Huang, when he spoke about sort of the typical business model that hospitals practice in today. What do reference laboratories do, and what could they do, both today and in the future? And then clearly, what are those pain points that hospitals and their reference laboratories share in this environment? And my belief is that the pains are a little different than those pains that have been in the past. They've just been magnified intensely by today's economic conditions. Now, you've seen various versions of this information and know that our trajectory in national health expenditure in the United States is unsustainable. So there is clearly a national dialogue that I think is more intense today than perhaps it's been in the past, that's focusing on this crisis that also affects our long-term economic viability. We know that in the year spanning 2007 to 2008, our national health expenditure grew over a little over 6% to $2.4 trillion, a little over 16% of GDP, and that in 10 years, in 2018, that will nearly double. That's assuming an average annual growth rate of a little over 6%. And at that point, public funding for healthcare services, which today is about 47% of the total spend when you look at Medicare, Medicaid, and other state government programs, that's going to be more than 50% at this rate of growth. And again, clearly something that is unsustainable. I wanted to spend a few moments talking about the recently passed American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the economic stimulus package, because, as you know, there are several pieces of that funding that affect healthcare, and in particular affect embracing at a individual practice level health information technology and electronic medical records. And the access through CMS to significant funds will hopefully allow small physician practices, the 2, 3, 5 person groups that today really can't afford to spend significant money, if any money at all, on embracing EMRs. And I read with interest last week that there is a business opportunity here that Walmart clearly sees when they announced that they plan to work with Dell Computers and eClinicalWorks to put together these turnkey packages, affordable turnkey packages, to sell to these small physician practices to allow them to connect into an EMR and leave it to Walmart. We know that many states are suffering tremendously from the shortfall in their tax revenue base, and that translates into the inability to provide needed services to the uninsured and the impoverished. So having significant infusion of money into the Medicaid programs will hopefully help to offset some of this shortfall. And then I want to jump down to the last bullet, which Bruce talked about earlier this morning, on comparative effectiveness research, $1.1 billion being devoted to focusing on clinical effectiveness. And clearly the target here is in diagnostics and in therapeutics, and so lab tests and drugs. And some of those are going to be companion diagnostics, for instance, a specific lab test tied to a specific therapeutic. We've clearly seen that healthcare, though not recession-proof, is still proving to be a little bit more resilient than just about any other sector of our economy. Consumer staples is probably similarly resilient, but nevertheless, there's been significant loss in market value even within healthcare. But compared to the financial services sector, it's clearly far less dramatic. What's interesting is the statistic that over the last 12 months, ending in February, the hospital sector has added over 130,000 new jobs. I think the big question is, will this job growth continue to be sustainable, or will we now see hospital failures, financial failures, or, as I'll get to a little bit later, other constraints and other pressures to reduce costs? And in November, the American Hospital Association published a report on the impact that the economic situation was having on their members. And it's a long list of impacts that include relative inaccess or lack of access to capital for needed expansion projects, and this ripples through to the laboratories, as I'll mention in a moment. And when it is available, it's at a much higher borrowing rate than in the past. So clearly that creates a challenge for hospitals to continue to grow. Patient mix and acuity have changed. Many hospitals, including ours at the University of Utah, are seeing far fewer elective admissions. Orthopedic procedures are way down, and other elective procedures like that. And when patients are admitted to the hospital, they're often much sicker. Some of them have already made that decision that I'm going to vote with my pocketbook to buy food or pay rent rather than pay to renew that drug prescription that they may clearly need. So some of that delaying may actually result in patients being sicker when they do present to the hospital. And in a recent survey, about 25% of Americans said that a family member has indeed postponed medical care in the past year due to those cost concerns. And I think we'll just continue to see that increase in intensity. Because for every approximate 1% increase in the unemployment rate, that translates into about 2.5 million additionally uninsured employees and their dependents. Many physicians are now turning to their hospitals to try and get financial support to sustain some aspects of their practices. And clearly many hospitals are now struggling with what were once rather narrow margins. In many cases, those margins have disappeared or are now running in a negative deficit. And then I mentioned before the impact of reduced or eliminated state Medicaid funding support and how that translates into less money for hospitals, particularly safety net hospitals in large communities, to be able to continue to foster their mission of providing care to the indigent, to the uninsured, the unemployed. This ripples through, of course, to hospital laboratories. What's interesting is that in spite of the continued demand for services to meet patient care needs, and we're seeing that in our own laboratory, where we thought that our growth rate would be in the 12 to 14% range. We're now running at greater than 16 to 18% growth. We just seem to be getting more specimens than we anticipated. So the growth is clearly there. But in the background, and it's sort of when is this shoe going to fall, starting to see hospitals call for broad, across-the-board departmental budget cuts, hiring freezes. If positions are open due to attrition, many of those open positions are now being frozen, so you can't hire, and that is creating tremendous stress on hospital laboratories as well as other departments. I mentioned access to capital, delayed or canceled capital expenditure projects as a result of that, and there may be needed upgrades in laboratory instrumentation or information technology hardware, software that are now being delayed because of this. Hospitals are seeing increasing bad debt. The amount of uncompensated care continues to rise as the unemployment rate goes up. And we're all just sort of taking the tactic that the longer we can delay our vendors, the more we can hold onto that cash. So that is translating into increasing days receivables and in some cases also increasing bad debt and accounts receivable failures. And calls to reduce services. Rather than expand services that may be needed in a particular hospital setting, there may be calls from hospital administration to reduce services. And to the extent possible, as we talk about laboratory testing, insource some of these tests that you're now sending out to a reference laboratory, but you can't have the money to support new technology, new instrumentation to do that. But we want you to do that as best you can anyway. Just reduce your send-out budget. And I'll come back to that a little bit later as clearly a pain point between hospital laboratories and reference laboratories. In this backdrop, there's this continuing trend of a number of factors in laboratory medicine. Many of these are not new, but in some respects are becoming intensified. First and foremost is the commoditization of laboratory-based medical services. And to some extent, as I put up on the slide, we are our own worst enemy when it comes to this, because clearly the drive for a long, long time has been to improve precision, to improve accuracy, to standardize across methods and across platforms, to introduce automation into our processes, all intended to improve patient safety, reduce variation, improve turnaround times, lower costs, and that starts to sound like a commodity business. Of course, we're in a healthcare system that's predominated by fee-for-service as a payment model, and when you do the math, reductions in total spending means you either have to reduce the volume, so utilization reduction, reduce the price, or some mix of the two of those in order to get your total spend down, and in this case, in laboratory services. And of course, aggressive reimbursement reduction pressures at all levels from all payers, but in particular from Medicare, continues to squeeze margins closer and closer to our actual cost of production. And at some point, you just can't squeeze anymore. And we have this annual uncertainty of where is the Medicare clinical laboratory fee schedule going to go, where is the Medicare physician fee schedule going to go, and what impact that will have on our services. We know that for the physician fee schedule, for instance, that is part of this program sustainable growth rate formula that Congress CMS uses, that in on January 1st of 2010, we can anticipate a little over a 20% cut in physician fees, unless Congress intercedes like they have done nearly every year in the past, because physicians are a strong lobby. And then we, Bruce talked a little bit about, and other speakers have talked a little bit about reform models and how will that affect our services, how we get paid for our services, how we deliver those, whether it's in some form of a bundled payment model or a medical home model where fee-for-service will still exist, but perhaps in a different with a different formula. And then finally, in terms of this whole idea of commoditization, what about the value of what we do? We've heard repeatedly that 5% of the spend translates into 70% of decision-making information in medical charts. That's a wonderful value for the dollar spent in comparison to other forms of medical technology. But value doesn't really get rewarded in this kind of a commodity-based pricing market, one that's constantly focused on getting the price per unit down further and further. Other trends, clearly the increasing decentralization of diagnostic services, more and more black boxes that will clearly move more care in the future to the bedside, to the clinic side, which will improve patient convenience, physician convenience, and the ability to make decisions quickly. Increasing pressure on physicians to more effectively utilize these often costly diagnostic services, both lab and imaging, to maximize clinical efficiency. And that's especially true with chronic disease management and oncology management, where the ultimate goal should be to improve the medical appropriateness of those services and patient outcome, that is the efficacy of those services, while reducing spend on unnecessary services. So physicians are continually under that pressure to do only what's medically necessary and appropriate and get paid for only doing that. In the increasing complexity of our diagnostic services technology, both imaging and in lab and pathology, creates more and more information and knowledge content that for the average physician can be quite daunting, especially a primary care physician who may be on the forefront in future models of healthcare to make decisions about what their patients should get, who they should see, what kind of services they would benefit from. Demands a higher skilled workforce to perform and report in our laboratories, and clearly places that greater burden on providers to make those rational decisions. So that to the extent that we as laboratorians can help physicians better understand how to navigate through those complexities and use these services appropriately and financially judiciously. It's already been mentioned that we continue to need more and more medical technologists and similarly trained individuals to staff our workforces as these technologies proliferate. The United States Bureau of Laboratory Statistics has estimated that 10 to 12,000 new positions per year are going to be needed over the next 10 years to meet these challenges and these demands. And we're only graduating about half of those that number. And the average age of a medical technologist is getting close to 50 years. And many of them are either retiring or, in today's economy, may be looking for other opportunities in other careers outside of laboratory medicine. So that attrition impacts us. And as Bruce repeatedly and so eloquently describes it, this emerging convergence of laboratory medicine, anatomic pathology, and imaging into this discipline that could be thought of as diagnostic medicine. And clearly, some very big vendors have put a great deal of money into the proposition that this convergence will continue, and they will probably be part of the driving force to make that happen. Hospital outreach for pathology and clinical laboratory services continues to grow, and it continues to represent an opportunity for a hospital laboratory and a hospital administration that partners with them to compete against the national laboratories in a very effective way, because the best care, as we know, is care that's delivered locally. And so if you can, as a hospital laboratory, essentially act like a commercial laboratory with sales and marketing, with client services, with a service mentality, appropriate pricing, and IT support, you can compete effectively with the large commercial laboratories. Turning now to look at our nation's hospitals and where some of those pain points are. Clearly, hospitals exist as institutions that have very complex systems with the intent of managing patients and providers with very, very broad, diverse needs and wants. And there are a variety of different types of hospitals. Clearly, in most communities, the community hospital that as Dr. Huang described yesterday, tries to be everything to everyone, predominate in many communities, but there's clearly a variety of other delivery models in our health system. They provide the locale, the facility, and process infrastructure for physicians and other healthcare providers to diagnose, treat, and manage both acute and chronic disease. And again, to come back to our reimbursement model, for the most part, we are in a health system that's dominated by third-party insurers and government payers who either use fee-for-service or some form of a bundled payment policy to reimburse for our services. So what do hospitals need to succeed? First and foremost, provide high-quality, affordable care, and really inspire within their communities the confidence of patients, physicians, staff, payers, and employers, all the stakeholders of a community hospital. Sustain a strong referring physician base. That's the revenue source for the hospital. Manage both acute and chronic disease effectively, efficiently, and cost-effectively. Reduce errors and try and minimize costly variation in care and care delivery. Judiciously manage and utilize services. And first and foremost, from a cost-effectiveness standpoint, really focus on how well they can manage their costs. Dr. Huang described yesterday the three hospital business models that exist, and really most hospitals today are trying to compete in the two realms of being solution shops and value-adding processes as well. Very little focus has been devoted, at least in most hospitals, to this idea of a facilitated network business model. And as particularly as it relates to reference laboratory services, we know that in most of these hospitals that are both solution shops and value-adding processes, that the high-volume procedures really subsidize the unique low-volume specialized capabilities, the esoteric clinical services like transplantation, for instance. And when you have that, then when you look at the ancillary services needed to support that, both in imaging, in lab, as well as in pharmacy, that those esoteric procedures and care services drive the need to have ready and available access to these esoteric ancillary services, a high-cost area of the laboratory. So for hospitals, key strategic attributes like focusing on quality, being cost-effective, providing convenience and accessibility to patients and physicians, when driven by pricing, performance, and quality data, really require careful and effective alignment between patient and physician incentives. And that's something that doesn't really work well in our current system, at least in part because of this tremendous focus on fee-for-service payment, where the more you do, the more you make. There's no incentive in there to manage utilization effectively if someone is losing in that equation. Key cycles for hospital success: the patient cycle, the revenue cycle, and the supply cycle. We talk with our CEO of our hospital. These are the three primary areas that he focuses on in terms of his dashboard. Under patient cycle, delivery of necessary services on-site to physicians and patients, managing effective patient flow through the system so people don't get stuck, they get triaged appropriately, and they move through the system expeditiously. And for the inpatient side, that's really optimizing length of stay. Clearly, providing accessibility is important, so having outpatient clinics, for instance, that are readily accessible and easy to use by patients is very important. Reducing delays and reducing mistakes. On the revenue cycle side, optimizing clean claim submissions and timely and as full as possible collections from insurers optimizes revenue. And on the supply cycle side, optimizing expenses throughout the hospital supply chain of vendor products and services is very important, including laboratory services and reference laboratory services. So drilling down on each of these three areas a bit and then looking at where there are opportunities between a hospital laboratory and a reference laboratory to try and meet some of these challenges more effectively. ready access to these critically important decision-making services, so service lines, service menus, broad laboratory menus, and access to timely results, and how to interpret and effectively use those services are also important. So hospital laboratories are making these decisions. What do I do? What do I keep on my own menu? So what do I do inside the four walls? What do I outsource to a reference laboratory, for instance? And they make these, do these make versus buy analyses. And I think that's really an important opportunity to really focus on what do you need to do within the facility to meet the patient care needs, how often do you need to do those, and what kind of turnaround time is going to be critically important to keep patients moving through the care system. Minimizing reporting delays through effective and timely process management, so handling the exceptions when they occur, assessing and acting on specimen integrity issues and order integrity issues as well. Wrong order on the right specimen, right order on the wrong specimen, those kinds of things. Specimen collection and transport processes, having clear collection requirements that are readily available to whoever is going to be collecting those specimens, whether it's on the floors or in the physician's office and the outpatient clinics or what. And then ready access for questions. This is really the client services part of what we should be doing in the hospital laboratory. If a physician or a nurse or other practitioner, either in-house or in a clinic or in an office, has a question about, I don't understand the collection requirements, we need to be readily available to do that. And then how we get those specimens from the collection site to wherever it's going to be ultimately tested. Clearly, the need for robust QC and QA programs so that we're minimizing variations in our services and driving failures to as close to zero as possible. And here's another important opportunity where health information technology connectivity solutions, either between labs, the reference lab, or between labs and physician offices, can be very, very effective in managing these handoffs. On the revenue cycle management side, attention to payer coverage policies and payment terms. So really minimizing denials through submitting, trying to always submit a clean claim the first time, and maximizing our collections from those. One aspect of the care model today is that physician preference demand patterns can really alter the most efficient and effective way that those services are provided. And in some cases, those services, when they're, certain services are demanded by a physician because, I've always done it that way, or I've always used this other laboratory, I want you to send it there, can result in the hospital being left holding the bag on the cost of those services. So this is clearly an opportunity for utilization management strategies. Hospital community outreach successes and the services necessary to support them, I already touched on. These elements that are really important for a hospital outreach program, whether it's clinical laboratory, anatomic, or both, to look and feel like a commercial laboratory. And from a cost standpoint and an efficiency standpoint, this is really an opportunity to fill laboratory capacity with a more profitable volume. So the hospital laboratory can now become a revenue center in addition to clearly being a cost center. Supply cycle management, contracting and price negotiations. Now, what's the goal there? Is it to reduce the line-by-line, service-by-service cost, so the individual unit cost, or is it to reduce aggregate spending on the entire family of services? And from, we talk about the relationship between a reference laboratory and a hospital laboratory, is it on the entire send-out spend, or is it on trying to work each individual test to get the best price possible. Clearly, that's the easier way out and is the way to squeeze suppliers in the most effective way if you're viewing it from that standpoint, and just asking for across-the-board reduction in charges. And, of course, we should all be looking for, and I think we all do look for, ways in which we can improve our cost structure. But at some point, you just can't squeeze any further. So then you have to start looking at the harder, I would argue more sustainable strategies to drive out unnecessary utilization of these services, which can be so costly, so that your aggregate spending now aligns with optimal clinical outcomes. So here's really another critical opportunity to reduce total aggregate spending through utilization management. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's something that, when done effectively, can be a win-win for the hospital laboratory, the reference laboratory, and the physicians and patients. Because when you consider it, pathology and laboratory medicine services are really subjected to a derived demand model, economic model. Others are deciding what we do, how much we do of it, and in that sense, what we're going to get paid. So we're not creating our own demand in that sense. So the roles of reference laboratories, with very, very few exceptions, all clinical laboratories around the country, ours included, contract with reference laboratory for those services that we can't do ourselves for whatever reason. And first and foremost, we should provide accurate, timely, and clinically effective laboratory services at a reasonable price. That's really the primary stock and trade of a reference laboratory. And when you look at the realm of reference laboratories across the country, there are the large national labs, the esoteric commercial labs, there are a lot of regional independent laboratories. Many academic medical centers effectively act as reference laboratories in their regions. And then very small niche specialized laboratories, or as I call them, one-test ponies. Reference laboratory contracting has become pretty complex today. It's no longer this sort of handshake agreement between the laboratory, the pathologist, and the reference laboratory that here's our services, here's the fee schedule, when can you start kind of thing. Now it's really managed through detailed contracting involving many, many individuals on both sides of the equation. But in hospitals, clearly the preeminent role of pathologists and laboratory administrators in the past, I think, is now taking somewhat of a backseat to purchasing departments, materials managers, and hospital administrators. And that's probably going to be even more true now in the current economic conditions. And I can't emphasize this point enough. Any of you who've gone through a transition from one reference laboratory to another, it is not a trivial undertaking. It takes months, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and expense to do it right. The other dynamic in contracting are the group purchasing organizations, GPOs, which on a national level negotiate contracts on the part of their member hospitals and hospital systems. And I put quotation marks here, ideally balancing price and service quality, but really, for the most part, driving for that lowest price per unit for their members, because that's how they'll look good. And then if you're a reference laboratory that is awarded that contract, and with large GPO contracts, you're usually one of two, perhaps three awardees. What you've gotten, what you've been awarded, is really a hunting license to now go to each member and convince them of your value under the contract. And then reference laboratories under that arrangement pay the GPO an administrative fee that's usually in the range of 2 to 3% of total spend, contract services spend per year, which with most GPOs, they keep part of that to manage their administrative costs, and part of it goes back to the members as rebates, especially if they're 100% compliant with the contract. And there are very intricate tiered pricing models that are used within these contractual arrangements. Value adds, so anything beyond stock and trade is really value added, including consultation services at a variety of different levels, the most obvious being medical consultation, tools for effective utilization management, and in some cases business solutions like developing successful outreach programs. IT connectivity solutions are often part of the value add, whether it's interfacing between two LISs or other means of lab-to-lab communication. And then in many cases now, to support these outreach programs, to help the hospital laboratory develop competitive physician office connectivity solutions to their EMRs. And then logistics management of specimen delivery and tracking, including within the system itself. So this is my last slide. And what I wanted to really emphasize are, again, where I see the opportunities exist between a hospital laboratory and a reference laboratory in that partnership to look at the challenges, the pain points that I've talked about, and see where those can be optimized, can be minimized, or can be eliminated. Hospitals need to deliver services that their physicians and patients require for appropriate care decision making. I think reference laboratories can really help not only in providing timely and accurate medical laboratory services, but also helping them manage on the revenue cycle side their primary revenue sources, whether it's allowing hospital laboratories to present very accurate, timely, and collectible claims to insurers, minimizing denials, minimizing those situations where the hospital gets stuck holding the bag on a very costly send-out, or working with hospitals to develop new revenue sources, such as supporting them in their outreach activities. And then helping hospitals to effectively manage expenses and supplies through ways in which to improve the utilization of these costly services and reduce their overall aggregate spending on send-outs rather than trying to focus on individual test pricing and using utilization tools at the physician level, I think, is critical in achieving that endpoint for both hospitals and their reference laboratories. So, thank you very much. And I didn't cough once.
Thank you, Dr. Weiss. He's got to run out and catch a plane, so he's not going to be here for our Q&A. So if you have a burning question, you'll just have to trip him on the way out, unless you want to take a couple now. Do we have time? We're into the break time. It's up to you. Well, okay. We'll take an hour break. We'll be back here at 4:05. And we'll talk about RFPs and contracts, so I know that'll hold your attention before you go for the green beer.